And this is where there would be fanfare, were there to be fanfare. And maybe there will be. Maybe there will be some fanfare in post-production. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Andrew Farmer.
If there's fanfare and then you hear the fact that there should have been fanfare, it's only because we weren't certain.
That's right. That's, of course, the Jedi Cole Houston. And you are listening to the one-year annual of Hey Kids Comics. That's it. That's it, guys. You can cut us in half and we have one ring as of what right now. And you can take that to Mordor and throw it in a mountain for all I care. What? No. Yeah, I love you guys. So, this is our very special episode. We've been hinting about it for the past, four or five shows. We're celebrating our one-year mark as only we can by letting somebody else do the work. So...
We're outsourcing this part of our anniversary.
That's right.
Pass the savings on to you.
So we figured what better way for us to celebrate our anniversary as a show and celebrate it with all of you, the listeners, which, you know, again, as we talked about last issue, we wouldn't be doing this without you guys, but to have some interviews and talk to some of our regular cast members. And we asked them all one question. Cole, what was that question?
That question, of course, would be, what was the best comic you ever read?
That's right.
Not a simple question to answer. The gnashing of teeth when it was first asked. We had the foresight to ask weeks in advance.
We had epinephrine pins. There's a flushing of skin. It's an allergic question is what it is. It really turns the stomach of a comic book reader to have to identify one single issue. So we gave a few stipulations. We said, okay, it doesn't necessarily have to be an issue. It has to be an issue or a story arc or a collect or a graphic novel, a standalone, which the riots stopped, at least. The streets grew quiet, and the pitchforks and the torches were put away, and we got down to business, as it were.
Yes, I think once people realized they didn't have to narrow it down to a single story or a single issue, they could.
Right, right.
But the choice was theirs. It could be the entire series, just a series that spoke to them. One issue, one storyline, an arc, a miniseries, whatever it may be. But what was, if they had to just sort of, you know, sit before Congress and under oath swear what was the best comic they ever read, this wouldn't be that severe. But close.
Correct. Nobody's filibustering Hey Kids Comics.
And nobody worries about contempt of Hey Kids Comics.
No, it's in contempt of itself. This whole court is in contempt, Cole. This whole court. You know, we got some really interesting responses, and honestly, they weren't a lot of. It wasn't what I was expecting, and everybody will get to hear all these, you know, as we go. And what we're planning on doing is Cole and I are going to talk a little bit about just a little bit about our favorite comic book we've ever read, and then we're going to do some brief. You know, you're going to hear the interviews, and you're going to hear us introduce them a little bit, and we're going to come back to you at the end of the show and close it out for you and tell you what's coming up next week, but. The responses we got were really interesting because it wasn't a lot of what I expected it to be, which was Green Lantern, you know, 465, because I really like Green Lantern, and he made a tennis racket, and that was great. There were a lot more deep and meaningful conversations than I think I was expecting. So, you know, kudos to all you comic fans out there for seeing deeper.
Absolutely. You go into this not knowing what you're going to get. I kind of expected a much broader mix, but everybody was so deep. They just took it very seriously. There was none of this sort of Chris Farley, like, yeah, I read this issue of Batman. It's awesome.
Right, yeah. Well, why was it awesome?
Because it was awesome.
Right, because he had batarangs. Like, you know, people were really deep about this. I was really impressed. So, that being said, I don't know if I know what Cole's favorite comic book he's ever read is. I know what his favorite 12-issue miniseries or standalone maxi series that he's ever read is. And I don't know if this is within the realm of that.
You know, that it's hard to walk away from that. I basically had to put that on the shelf and say, the best comic I've read, other than Watchmen.
Because, you know, that's like saying the best book I ever read was War and Peace. And no.
Yeah, I had to look at it from the standpoint of there are hours upon hours of recorded material.
Literally.
Out there that you can find with me talking about Watchmen. I mean, we did 12 episodes of Amazing Comicast. I don't know for certain, but I suspect that if you dissected the airtime for everybody.
Right.
I'm just going to go on a limb and say, you know, I don't usually try to take these things over per se, but I bet I did not shut up.
Well, the thing is, the industry, and I will refer to it as an industry, where they have the little cups and balls, you know, like where you have the little cup and then you have the ball attached to the string. Where you flip the ball up and try to catch it in the cup. Industry had really, really waned out of existence around, I think, 54, 55. During the period of Amazing Comicast where you talked about Watchmen, it really skyrocketed only because I'm pretty sure that your co-hosts kept breaking them and then having to rebuy them while they sat there and listened to you talk about Watchmen.
That's right. I think at some point when they were recording that those episodes, Rick would occasionally just leave and return the next day to see, you know, once we got into the semifinals of whatever I was talking about.
Right,
so
right.
It was best to leave that as read, as it were. There's no shortage of places you can find me talking up Watchmen.
So. Right. So with that being said, Cole, what's the favorite? What's the best comic book you've ever read?
Where do you go from there? And like everyone, I think you're probably going to hear this a lot, is how do you do that? You guys are evil.
Right.
And we're going to go ahead and turn the tables on ourselves a little bit. So I went with a comic that I remembered seeing, didn't bother with it. And then I read, I want to say, oops, sorry about
Did
that.
Did you just set off the wall saber?
I actually, the lightsaber thing that never goes off. Because it's too dark on that side of the room. I go pick up this book and the thing.
Cole is so worked up over this question that he set off his wall saber.
My Walmart store display just set itself off. It was so excited about it.
And that statement, oddly enough, is not sexual in nature. Okay, so
as strange though it is, yeah, other things coming later might be, but that notwithstanding, I think I may have read about this in Wizard.
Okay,
which makes it, that's why I'm sort of incredulous, because I can't imagine Wizard having good advice.
You're starting dubiously, but where are we going to go?
But I can't say with certainty, but I think it may have been brought up in some little Wizard thing where they weren't having fart jokes.
Right.
And instead bothered to say, you know, here's some things you ought to be checking out because they're available in trade paperback.
Right.
It was a miniseries that effectively is a Batman book. It's Arkham Asylum Living Hell.
Okay.
But you can look it up. I'm not going to give you all the credits. Because I'll probably mispronounce things. Oh, no, that's not how you pronounce his name. I met him at this convention.
Right.
So Arkham Asylum Living Hell is a 4-issue limited series.
Okay.
That, if, you know, I say effectively it's a Batman book because Batman pops in from time to time.
He's the Mr. Roper of this book.
He really is. He's always like Kramer on Seinfeld. Like every now and again, the door will fly open and there's Batman.
Right.
But what it's really about is more like the dark corner of Gotham City that is Arkham Asylum. It literally is an Arkham Asylum book.
Okay.
And what's fascinating about it is it utilizes to a small degree existing Batman mythology characters, like Two-Face and Joker. Riddler appears. Killer Croc has a fairly predominant role.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really, because you've got those characters, and then within the context of the asylum, you wind up running into characters you've never seen before that are inmates.
Okay.
And what's new about it, you can sort of say, okay, well, we've never heard of this character, probably because they've been in there for a long, long time. But they're characters that work in the Batman universe. Because of the nature of Batman's Rogues Gallery.
Right. Have any of the, to your knowledge, have any of the characters that were kind of, if not invented, if for this book, pulled out of, you know, the morass of continuity, have they ever been brought back?
Yeah, the interesting question to me would also be, and I don't know, I wasn't following the books, if there was any precedent for any of these characters. Like maybe they, as an editorial decision, they said, oh, here, put Junkyard Dog in this issue. and then that way he can wind up being in Arkham Asylum Living Hell. But what was nice about it is it took the old chestnut of let's create new characters that are expendable because they're going to, in some cases, be dead by the end. Or yeah. drastically altered by the end, not to give away too much. But you know how it is. You can often tell who the red shirts are because they're non-entity characters. They're cardboard cutouts you've never seen.
Yeah, Slicer Jones or exactly. Switchblade Johnny Ramirez or something. And you're like, it's, oh, God, okay.
Iguana or something, you know. Was there ever a Mickey the Iguana? Well, there wasn't because he's dead.
But, he was in one issue. Yeah. Don't worry, Jeff Johns is going to bring it, or Grant Morrison will bring him back in something where he was the secret mastermind.
Exactly. He'll be in, like, Identity Crisis 2 or something.
Exactly.
But you had really compelling characters like Jane Doe, who basically is an identity thief, too, both literally and figuratively.
Okay, so she was almost like a Clayfacean.
Except without the ability to physically change herself, but that has a bearing there. And you had a character called Doodlebug.
Okay.
Who was like a street graffiti artist type.
By the way, my new favorite word is Clayfacean.
Clayfacean.
Where did that come from? Guys, I'm tired. All right. I'm sorry in advance.
I like the fact that we continue to add to the vernacular here.
I like the fact that you didn't even bat an eye. I said Clayfacean, and you just was like, yep.
I'm just so used to creating our own vocabulary that okay. I'm Clayfacean just is immediately now.
In the vernacular, yes. It's now a part of society. It's now a part of the Hey Kids Comics society. So why was this book the one that you pick out as the or the series, the collected, the one that you pick out as, on top of everything that's not Watchmen, the one for you?
It's because it takes the Batman universe in a unique direction, and it gives you one of the principal characters as one of the inmates of the asylum is Humpty Dumpty.
Okay.
And Humpty Dumpty works because you have a presence with the Mad Hatter and Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Right.
But at the same time, then it becomes like, okay, why have we never seen Humpty Dumpty? I mean, yeah, you can say, well, he's been in the asylum all this time.
Right.
But in his backstory, what was brilliant, the reason you don't know Humpty Dumpty is because they made him a Batgirl villain.
Oh.
In his backstory, Batgirl is the one who cracks the case.
Okay.
And because what's brilliant there is because her adventures are not as heavily chronicled as Batman's.
Right.
It makes perfect sense that a huge character in the tale, a vital character in the tale.
Nice.
Is basically a Batgirl villain. Would have been her rogues gallery, as it were. And Humpty Dumpty is one of these characters. The other thing that was brilliant about the characterization is in the flashbacks of Humpty Dumpty himself.
Yeah.
They managed to illustrate the way his mind works by all of his stuff is done like a children's storybook.
Okay.
So you go from very dark, somber colors palette to bright and airy. The art style changes. Everything changes. And then there are weird little nuances, too, that make it even more surreal, like, you know, he'll be walking down the street and one person has the head of a chicken.
Just because that's the way he sees it.
Exactly. And you realize, no, that isn't like chicken face or anything. That's, I avoided the obvious. I'm not turning this into Urban Dictionary. But because that's the way he perceives it in his storybook mind. And furthermore, his very nature becomes very important. Because who winds up on the scene, none other than the demon Etrigan.
Oh, man.
So there is this whole mystical undertone.
Yeah.
That really goes back to Arkham Asylum. Oh, it was a hardcover. It was like Hell on Earth or something like that.
I think so. Yeah.
A decade or more ago. And so it basically goes back to that kind of arcane origin. It brings in mysticism. It brings in the Batman Rogues Gallery. It brings in the demon who very few people have ever written the demon well.
It is a hard character to pin down.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And the demon is written very well. Batman is written very well in his occurrence. And then you have a character, you literally get to watch a brand new Batman villain be born.
And who is that?
That is a character that becomes a character that I do know just from getting curious one time and checking and seeing further images that suggest that he did finally, you know, they did actually incorporate him into the greater Batman universe.
Yeah.
The Great White Shark.
Okay. I think I am familiar with that character. I just don't know exactly.
But to see the progression of the character, because he starts out as a much different character, and hopefully without giving away too much, what the story revolves around is a white-collar criminal.
Yes.
Who has his court, you know, he's basically been brought in. He has his court venue moved to Gotham City, basically gambling that is the one place in all the world he can complete insanity.
It's a pretty brilliant idea.
Yes, except for one thing.
When you plead insanity in Gotham City.
Yeah, there's one place to go, and he didn't count on that.
Right. They're like, yeah, we'll put you in there.
Yeah, so if you're criminally insane, we'll put you in with the Joker and Two-Face and Humpty Dumpty.
Apparently. Well, that's cool.
It takes the familiar characters and does wonderful, fun, curious things with them. Our white-collar criminal has a shower, has to go in the big shower room and is confronted by none other than the Joker.
Which implies that the Joker showers regularly, which I don't know. I mean, we should do an entire show on comic book hygiene.
I don't know. The thing about it is, if you think about it, I've never owned one, but if I understand that, like, if you own a white car,
yeah,
you're doing nothing but washing the
That's damn true.
I think the Joker showers ever, just all the time.
That is annual material right there, guys. Clayfacian and the Joker showers all the time, white car analogy. You can't get that anywhere else. This is the entertainment that we bring you.
This has been a year in the making.
I'm thrilled with that. Absolutely thrilled with that. Do you have any closing statements on your favorite?
I think that I'd have to say, This I'm pretty sure was once one of my recommended reading over at United States of Geekdom.
Okay.
I have to say, if you're a Batman fan, or even if you're not,
right,
you don't have to know Batman to enjoy this. I think that's the really important thing. This is something anyone can go into because it's a self-contained story.
Right. So basically just go get it and read it.
That's right.
Fair enough.
Like you used to always say on Collector Sector about Walking Dead. You're right. Going to read
it. You're going to read it. You know what it is. You're going to read it. Just go read it. So I need to pick that up at some point. You did talk about it on USG at some point. I remember it now. But we didn't go as far in depth as we have tonight. So I'm glad that you told me more because it really has piqued my interest. So I want to check that out.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one you want to look for. You know, if you can find it in the half-price trades, so much the better. But it's worth the money.
Okay.
Because it is a satisfying read. It's one I can go back to again and again because it's just so well done. And the fact that the changes in the style, the art, and the unique characterization, and just that this whole progression, that this one character literally is living hell on earth.
Yeah.
And where it takes him coming out the other side.
Well, cool. All right. Well, great. Thank you. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
See, mine is a little different. Mine is not a contained story. Mine I have actually talked about on this show before, but I want to revisit it, and I'm not going to go on at length. If you want to hear me go on at length about it, I'm pretty sure I did it at some other point. I believe it was in our Violence in Comics issue very early on. But I did a little more research on it to refresh my memory. It's a comic that came out in September of 1986. It was Captain America 321. And if you remember right, I had talked about it, and I had talked about the fact that it was the issue that I was so shocked about because Captain...
Is that the one with Batroc the Leaper?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's the one where Batroc the Leaper was in drag, convinced him that it was Agent Sharon Carter, and then pulled it off and...
That was a beautiful story.
It was right up to the end.
Yeah.
Right up to that crying game moment where you're like, what?
Exactly. And you're amazed that no one noticed his Salvador Dalian mustache.
What is with us today? And is that an ad? Is that an adverb? Like, what is that, an ad now?
Batroc the Leaper uses Dapper Dan on his whiskers.
Did we invent an ad noun? Is that what we invented?
That's right.
We invented the ad noun tonight. It's the issue where Cap is going to break up the terrorist cell of the Flag Smasher. I believe is the one where it is. Yes, Flag Smasher. It's written by Mark Grunwald, and he goes to Montclair, and then somewhere in Europe to break up this thing. And I had it wrong originally.
All the more reason to go back, actually. Right.
What happened, in my mind, was he shot up the Flag Smasher with an Uzi on a plane. In reality, what happened is he shoots a henchman, and it goes into detail in the actual panel of this book to explain what happens. He shoots a henchman with an Uzi because he's in disguise as one of these other henchmen who kind of look like a cross between a speeder... What are they called? The speeder bike stormtroopers?
Oh, the biker scout.
Yeah, okay. Biker scout and Ultron Cafe members.
The backup singers for Ultron Cafe.
Yeah, he's in disguise, and part of the disguise that he takes it off of one of the guys, you know, an Uzi, and one of the terrorists gets the order and opens up on a crowd of hostages. And he can't get to the guy to stop him, so he has to shoot him. Well, this was one of the first comic books, and this is a nostalgic thing for me. This was one of the first comic books I ever bought on my own. You know, that was one of mine. And it was my first introduction to, okay, comic books aren't just kid stuff. You know, keep in mind, this was back when Marvel had their No Kill initiative. Do you remember that?
Yeah. In fact, I was about to say, I remember reading a thing. There was a thing one time where they did an editorial thing about sending in submissions and just like tore some poor guy's submission all apart.
Right.
For his script that he'd sent. Down to nitpicking, the way Russian surnames are structured.
Jeez.
And there was one point where, you know, Captain America says, damn. Well, Cap would never say damn.
Right, right. Cap doesn't kill people. And that's the thing about this is, you know, going back now, and also I want to say this. When I bought this, I bought it because of the cover. It has an iconic cover. It has a cover. The cover of the issue is Cap. It's a black background, and it's Cap in very stark contrast shooting an Uzi with rage face. That's the cover. I had been a comic fan for a very long time, even up to that point. You know, I was reading comics for a couple of years before I got that, and I'm pretty sure that I talked to, you know, whoever into buying it, whether it be my dad or my mom, I really wanted it because the cover looked really cool. And in reading it, I read it when I was that age, when it was new, and I put it aside and didn't think about it anymore. I went back and, like I said before, reread it again when I was probably 19, 20. And it had a pretty jarring effect on me then.
Absolutely.
Going back and reading it now, it's one of those spatial, temporal difference comics that you can read at different points in your life. And we talked about this too. I'm bringing the whole year home with this one issue, where if you read it at different points in your life, it means different things. And when I was 9 or 10, it was just a really cool comic. When I was 20, it really brought home the fact that I had always viewed Captain America in the way that he was portrayed as this, goody two shoes Boy Scout type guy. And this really brought home for me at age 20 that he was a soldier. He fought in wars. He knows how, he knows how to use a gun. He knows how to defend himself.
Exactly.
And he's willing to take life with, as if there's no other option on the table. That's his thing. Reading it again recently at 35 now, it really is a Trieste on violence and what it means, and what it means to buck the norm in the comics industry. Because I was doing my research on this, there was a firestorm over this book at the time that I wasn't aware of.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
People saying that Cap doesn't... they go in and... from the Marvel letter pages, of course, if you remember those. Things like neither Cap nor the Invaders ever carried guns behind enemy lines during the war. They never actively engaged in combat against the Axis militia, but concentrated their efforts on super agents and their leaders. We can't deny that Cap was the center of bloodshed.
So other people could do the killing.
Right, exactly. The regular guys could shoot each other up with guns. We're not going to worry about that. They say this, we can't deny that Cap was at the center of a lot of bloodshed during the big one, but he himself never shed another man's blood. The ultimatum incident in Cap 321 was the first time Cap intentionally took someone's life. Now, you could go back and read some of the war comics,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think you're...
I think there are a lot of assumptions people make about comics they never read.
Right, right. And then they have to address it, and that was in 327, so that was six issues after that issue. They address it again in the next issue, where they back down a little bit. His mission was to destroy the enemies of liberty, concepts such as fascism, Nazism, totalitarianism, which, by the way, is exactly what this book was about, which the Flag Smasher was about. Not to mention the fact that they took a bunch of hostages and were killing them, actually.
Yes, exactly.
But we're not saying Cap was ever a pacifist or is a pacifist. He does have a profound respect for human life. Killing an enemy is his last resort. And then it goes on in 329, and there is a full-blown, three-column, apparently they just did one one single letter to the editor in the back of this thing. But it was a big firestorm, and that's really what I wanted to talk about was the temporal nature of it. And we had talked about it before was, at age 10, it was a cool comic book. At age 20, it really informed me as to who the character is. Because I was never a Cap fan. I never knew I was a Cap fan. I'll say that because now I'm a Captain America fan. But I never knew I was. And then at age 30, it really is sort of a trieste on violence in comics, as well as a look behind the curtain, as we often do on the show, at the actual business itself. So... That's
oh, precisely.
Why.
And what's interesting there is, I think, like we were saying, that people made a lot of assumptions about the character because you didn't, this was a time where certainly the Punisher was about.
Right.
You could easily juxtapose Punisher and Captain America against each other, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, Cap's turning to Punisher. No, he hasn't.
It's a darker, grittier, no, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what has happened there is the story has taken a turn for the real.
Right.
If you will. And confronted with a situation where you have no choice. In fact, to me, this is more, more compelling than, say, spoiler alert, Superman cracking Zod's neck to save six people when, 36,000 were just crushed under rubble from their fist fight.
Can I say something real fast that's not comic related? just real fast.
Absolutely.
So I know that on the JCU, Pacific Rim, there's going to be at least one show on the movie Pacific Rim. And not to mention probably articles and everything else. But I just want to call this the summer of, oh, you think you can wreck a city? Bullshit. I'm going to show you how to wreck a city.
Right.
It's just a one-upsmanship on the destruction wholesale of habitated areas this year in the movie theaters.
Oh, I know. It's like you just...
Oh, my good God.
People made like Dante's Peak. You're like, wow, why did we even bother? We were
Well, I mean, that's the thing is you go see the Avengers, they're like, man, they really did a number on New York. Then you go see Superman, and you're like, wow, they really did a number on the Avengers. Then you go see Pacific Rim, and you're just like, I don't even know anymore. Yeah, what's next?
The only option at this point is just to park the Death Star over
right?
by the...
Right. Just split the Earth down the middle. Jeez, guys, come on. All right. So that was my favorite. Captain America 321. It's followed up in 322 if you want to really kind of follow the story arc, because they address it in the next one as well, but not in a huge way. But so 321 is really the one that I stand by as my favorite comic of all time. And that is, like Cole said, I was telling people that I was really glad that I didn't have to make this decision. And then Cole and I decided to make this decision because I have a short list of maybe 5 to 10, but narrowing it down to 1 was way too hard. I didn't like that at all. So, but that's it. So those are ours. Now, what we did was we went to some friends of the show and said, hey, guys, what's your favorite? And we did some short-form interviews gleaning this information from them, squeezing it and plying it from them in ways much like the KGB. So I will turn it over to Cole. Cole did our first interview, and I would wonder if you would like to do the intro for this one.
Absolutely. In fact, in some cases, when we were putting all this together, some folks went ahead and sent in.
Right.
They just sort of self-recorded. Because we brought in a lot of people who do a lot of podcasting. They're kind of accustomed to being behind a mic or sure. in front of a mic or what have you. And so a lot of them, it's just the participant talking.
Yes.
And then for some others, I think all the people that Andy talked to,
yeah,
it's Andy engaging them. And I
do love to hear.
I had a chance to engage her with hers.
I do love to hear my own voice, Cole.
That's true. But who doesn't love to hear your voice?
Everyone.
I'm sure you could provide a list.
I could, yes. It's written in lipstick on my bathroom mirror.
So, at any rate, we were very fortunate to the folks over at NCIS Live back at a North Dallas comic convention a couple of months back. I got talking to some Chris and Jason from that show, and they were just fascinated, intrigued by this whole concept of the best comic I ever read. And Jason was able to sit down and put together a little recording for us. very, very graciously
yes.
tackling this really difficult task.
Jason, thank you for that, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you guys for plugging it on your show months
wow.
in advance.
Yeah.
So if you've been wondering whatever became of that idea, here it is finally. And here's a voice, if you follow NCIS Live, that will be very familiar to you. Jason, giving us a little insight on the best comic he ever read, and it's really an unusual choice.
Hey, Jedi Cole, what's going on? It's Jason the X from SCNS Live. Thanks for letting me participate in this, man. Appreciate it. And my favorite comic, well, the best comic I ever read. Not necessarily. You don't pick easy questions, man. So, the best comic I ever read, honestly, had to be Hitman 34. It came at a point in my life when I kind of was questioning the state of the world. And when you see a guy like Tommy Monahan, who I was very very much vested into that character, I liked him from the get-go. But here you have him talking to Superman. And that's the one fault that Superman has. He's just that awesome. It's hard to bring him down to Earth. So when you have Superman sitting on a rooftop worried about this thing that he failed at, not failed, but you know, he couldn't affect the whole outcome of it. It makes the character human. That's one thing that Tommy Monahan was able to do. He's sitting on the roof with Superman and the guy reads him the Riot Act because he's beating himself up over something that there was no way there's no way that Superman can't ever make a mistake, even though the character, you know, he's perfect. But for Tommy to kind of take him to task and even tell him, this thing that you're worried about, it's stupid. Tommy's speech to Superman about the state of the of our country and how we could be the greatest country ever really hit me. As a kid who grew up a mixed race, being black and Japanese, and having to find my own path because it was either that or try to conform to these things that I didn't want to conform to. And Tommy really touches on that. He talks about how people immigrate to this country and they hang out with their own kind. They continue holding on to all the things that got them in trouble in the first place, like he says. And for what? But he looks at Superman and he says, you're the ultimate immigrant story. You came here and you didn't say, I'm from this country or here and these are my beliefs. You said, hey, I'm leaving all that behind because I'm an American. And what can I do to help? So, yeah, it really makes the Superman character just believable because that is exactly what the character did. And, you know, Tommy just, he was starstruck about seeing him. And then, you know, of course, he shoots a guy on the roof next to him. So, yeah, after Superman leaves. But it's one of the best comics I've ever read. That list could go on and on. Thanks for making me choose one. But it is definitely the one that I hold nearest and dearest to my heart. And, yeah, that's how I feel about that. So anyway, hey, y'all have a good show. Thanks for letting me do this, and keep on nerding.
Oh, thank you, Jason. That was awesome. Really appreciate it. Thank you for being part of this one-year celebration of ours.
Absolutely, and kind of kicking off the proceedings after we'd kicked them off ourselves, I guess.
Right.
But what's neat there is to, I think for me, to hear about Hitman was a book I never followed. I remember seeing it on coming down, you know, along with all the other titles that would have come out in the same month. And it just never looked like something appealing to me at all.
Right, right. I read it because it was fun. It's nothing that I read seriously, but I'm going to have to rethink that now. You know, that's the whole point of this. And I challenge all of you guys to come up with the best comic you've ever read. You know, come up with it, think about it, because it's a really interesting process to figure that out.
And of course, we do say that on a lot of our regular shows, we're going to revisit some topics, and we are working on that.
Yeah.
But this is definitely a topic that we chose for this annual because it was the ideal approach. But we're not going to wait a year to come back to this.
No.
Go ahead and write in to JediCole@yahoo.com.
Right.
We'll go ahead and just put this out right now. If you would like to participate in a future clip show like this, or because every now and again Andrew and I'd like to have a break and just record a bunch of bridges between.
We do. We just like to hang out and talk. So So email us and let us know. That would be awesome. All right. So to keep the ball rolling, our next two interviews are from Kelly. Kelly Long, who was recent guest on the show. You remember her from The Hero's Journey, where we talked about Wonder Woman and a centaur with a pickle in his butt. Yeah, it was the greatest, could be the greatest story ever told on this podcast. It was amazing. And Josh Alpert, who joined me to talk about the lesser known Marvel comic movies for one show. They joined us to remind us, and I'm not gonna give away what they talked about, but they joined us to remind us kind of together that comic books aren't just about action, and they aren't about what's on the surface. There's a lot of, if developed correctly, there's a lot of backstory and a lot of motivation that we don't usually think about until confronted with. So I'm gonna let you listen to a couple of wonderful interviews by some good dear friends of mine. I'm trying to think of what host I sound like right now, and I can't remember. And we'll come back afterwards and we'll talk about it a little more. Kelly, what is your favorite? What is the best comic you've ever read?
In my opinion,
in my humble opinion,
after many minutes of going, crap, I need to figure out what my favorite is. I made a list, and I whittled it down painfully to, I'm going to go Identity Crisis.
Boom! Bam. That is solid. You know, like we were talking before we started recording, and I said, I hope I don't have to choose. I'm glad I don't have to answer this question.
Yeah.
Though, if I did have to answer it, this would be in my top five.
It was a really hard choice, and because I have a lot of dedication, of course, to many different characters. But this one, yeah. You, of course, I mean, we have the love of the Green Lantern, so it was really hard to steer away from Blackest Night, because Blackest Night is a fantastic story.
It has its moments.
We'll
talk later about that. We'll have you on for that one.
Fair enough. Okay.
So why Identity Crisis?
Identity Crisis comes to us with real emotional problems, and that is where I love my superheroes. I mean, I love my superheroes because they can leap tall buildings in a single bound and bust some ass with lasers and lasses and stuff, and it's great. But what I really love is when my heroes have to deal with things that could possibly happen to me, too.
Okay.
Chances are I'm not going to run into Cersei on the street, even though I'd probably get really excited about it and then get blown up. But the stuff that happens in Identity Crisis, I certainly have. Parts of it. Not all of it. But certainly parts of it.
Sure. Let me play devil's advocate a little bit.
Sure.
Do you think it was... Do you think it was, in some aspects, too dark?
Not at all. I think that what DC finally got the idea was that if you got to start going a little darker with your goody two-shoe people. It was very dark, but at the same time, it opened everyone up to all these wonderful parts of their character that we didn't get to see before. Darkness only shows where we're going to really be good. That's what's interesting about it.
It's true. So what you're talking about is a run. It was how many issues was it in comic form? Was it five or six?
I think it was six.
I can't reach it. It's on my shelf. I can't reach it.
I think it was six. But no, it was seven. Excuse me.
Okay.
Seven issues. Powerful.
Oh, it was insane. It was insane. I still quote it. I still cite it as one of the best comics I've ever read. What's your favorite part of all of it? Because I'm intimately familiar with this.
Certainly.
I mean, like, if you had to identify seven pages of this thing that really blew you away, on top of just the emotional content, can you do that?
Sure, absolutely. I'm going to go iconography also with the beginning of it. You have these major characters, but the major characters stand aside, and then you have to focus on the lesser characters. But then you see these major characters and how they deal with. How are they dealing with their emotions? How are they dealing with their grief? How are they dealing with their rage? And those moments when the only thing they know what to do is to go kick ass. And then the first scene where they're really going as a group to do something, Deathstroke just...
And my favorite scene. Absolutely. You and me, same page, as always.
Oh, my God.
Favorite scene.
And I love Deathstroke for lots of reasons, because as a youngster, I truly, truly loved the tales of the new Teen Titans, and a lot of powerful characters come out of that, but here's Deathstroke, and nobody ever really mentions it until later, like it came popular later after Identity Crisis reminded us that Deathstroke's a badass, and he's really going to do mess with you. Like, that moment that he hits Zatanna and starts making her throw up, and that whole, like, you take out the most powerful one first. And you don't really think about her being the most powerful, but she is, and it's awesome.
Right, he's a brilliant tactician, and he has that, you know, I can see 5 minutes or 5 seconds into the future, so with the proper planning, there's nothing that I can't do. My favorite was the Flash, when he knows, because he can see that 5 seconds, so he knows within 5 seconds exactly what to do, breaks the Green Lantern's willpower, takes out Zatanna, it's brilliant.
Oh, yeah, and you know, cuts off all the arrows, Green Arrow, completely pointless without his arrows, of course.
Right.
You know, cuts off, you know, Hawkman's wings, like, it's just brilliant, like, and it happens so fast.
It's brilliant, it's awesome. It's amazing. And the author of the book, Brad Metzler.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mystery writer, not before comics.
Yeah. Right.
So he understands something. He understands the story structure. Do you think that, how do you think that played in differently? If it would have been any other writer that wasn't familiar with that formulae, it would have been a whole different book.
Absolutely. Your story structure, you have to build. I mean, because it's kind of like a Christopher Nolan movie. If, you know, the switch doesn't mean a thing if you're not completely embedded in what you think the outcome is going to be. So here comes Meltzer and totally throws you off for a loop because here he's taking, you know who the bad guy is, you figure out who that is. But then he totally blows your mind by bringing that stroke and blobbering everything that you've ever thought. So what do you do then? And so what do the good guys do then? They try and figure out the puzzle. You know, they bring in all the really great guys. They bring in Mr. Miracle, which as far as I'm concerned, you can't have enough Mr. Miracle.
I agree.
And then the Metal Men, like I loved it when the Metal Men showed up.
Mm-hmm.
We need more. We need more figuring out. Batman's not good enough. Let's bring in the Metal Men.
Yeah, they went through that whole scene where they're like, okay, so we've got Wayne Tech, we've got New Guardian, I forget what they call it. They got they went through the list, the litany of all the kind of security systems that were built into the house that was, you know, that was infiltrated, and they still couldn't figure it out. And at this point, you as a reader are like, I can't figure this out.
Who's gonna figure this out? This is incredible. Right, and then, you know, Superman shows up, and it's like the Boy Scout knot line. Fantastic.
Right.
And that one joke that they've been making, they're trying to make for years, and they get to finally make it. And then, also, of course, one of the most things that stick out to me in this story is Wonder Woman shows up. Because they're going to ask the not guy, what does he know? And it's just that moment where Green Arrow is sitting there going, you know, you could tell us. And all you don't even see anything. You just see her hips and her lasso.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And you know, like, he can pull you through these and not even
blink. Exactly.
You know, of course, I'm just like, yeah. And surprise endings, you know, where you have, you're going through the story where it's a manhunt, but then you've got this horrible moment when Firestorm gets stabbed with the sword, and he's got to go, he's going to blow up everything, and then he blows up.
I know.
It was a constant emotional roller coaster. How are they going to make me cry next?
Right. So, in closing, what are your final thoughts on Identity Crisis? I know we've hit on a bunch of different things in the past 10 minutes, but what are your final thoughts on that?
Thank God I did not have to wait month to month for these issues to come out, that I bought it as one thing.
Right.
Certainly. But also, Identity Crisis, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the best pieces of storytelling in the DC universe. And needing New 52 really needs to go back and look at that if they really want their comics book to sell better.
Amen, sister. So thank you again, Kelly. You are amazing, and thank you for coming on and doing this interview.
Thank you, Andy.
Josh, what is the best comic you've ever read?
It was X-Factor number 87, and I'm talking about, like, the Peter David version of it, not the, like, the X-Factor Investigations. I'm talking about with, like, Havoc and Polaris and Wolfsbane and Strong Guy.
So after X-Factor, Jean Grey and Scott Summers, and after they brought those guys back as X-Factor, they had a series of X-Factor that was Havoc and Polaris and Jamie Madrox and those guys, right?
Yeah, the government X-Factor.
Okay. Okay. So why was this your favorite? Of all the comic books you've ever read, and I know that you've read a lot of comic books, like all of us. Why did this one stand out for you?
Well, let me just preface this by stating also that back in the day, like everybody, I used to read X-Men, like everybody. I don't like it as much as I do now. You know, I don't like it anymore. But back in the day, this was like kind of gave you an insight on superheroes in general. It gave you like a look behind the curtain, so to speak.
Okay.
How they are psychologically. To set you up, it's basically, it was, and you find out later, it was Doc Samson as in a psychology role, just sitting down and talking to the various members of the X-Factor cast and seeing how they ticked. And that just
kind of stood out to me as something different. There was no action. It was just all talk.
Okay.
And just it was amazing. And before he was the publisher in chief, actually, Joe Quesada did the art.
Yeah, Joe does an amazing job with art. Now, Peter David has there's two sides to Peter David, really. Peter David has a really good ability to write action, as we can see, like in most of the Hulk books that he did, which he's prolific on the Hulk books.
Oh yes.
But he also did a lot of like a almost like Bendis-esque exposition in a lot of his things, where, like you said, he gets to the bottom of a lot of psychological things as well. How did this differ from any of the other X-Factor books? Because I'm guessing you read all of them. Or at least most of them.
Well, I read a lot past. Like I said, it was just talk. All right, my Quicksilver.
Okay.
Petro. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's a douchebag. let's get down to the meat and bones. You know, he's a douchebag. Okay. Tells you why he's a douchebag, and it's.
Well, what did they say? What's discovered?
You know how when you end up it was. How you know when you go to like a grocery store and somebody writes a check and they don't know how to write a check and it just takes up most of the time. And you get irritated just by the small little nuances of just everybody's ineptness through the day because it just cuts your day just shorter.
Okay.
Or just makes it longer or whatever. That's how he spends most of his life, is everybody's doing everything slower and holds up his time. So, and you just went, wow, that is a great explanation of why he is who he is.
It makes sense.
Exactly.
So who was doing, like, okay, so you had X Factor. Was this like a government-sanctioned, like, therapy session thing?
Yeah.
Is that, okay.
Yeah, so it was Val Cooper, the government mutant liaison. if I remember,
I love these books. I love this part of. I love this run of the books where they were government agents, because not only did you get like all this, you know, mutant on mutant violence and fighting, but you also got like all this weird like bureaucracy stuff that they had to go through.
Exactly.
That had to piss off Quicksilver even more because we know how slow government is.
Exactly. You know,
like, why are you sitting here interviewing me? I'm so angry. I could be out doing 1,000 things at once, literally, and you are making me sit here and talk about my feelings.
Exactly. You know, and that's exactly it. Strong Guy, who is, you know, Guido, who I absolutely is one of the most underappreciated characters, always has a smile on his face, always cracking in jokes. It gets behind the scenes of why he, you know, is the way that he is, and that is he's constantly in pain because of his mutant powers and his deformities and whatnot. And he just says, always keep him, you know, always leave him with a smile. Always keep him laughing. And you're like, that's great. Maddox, why does he, you know, why was he at the time cracking all the jokes and still being like the sideman to Strong Guy? And it's because he never wanted to be alone anymore. And that's because he was raised, if you know Maddox's backstory, he was raised on a farm by himself because his parents, I can't remember if he killed them or somehow they were murdered. So he was living by himself. So he never wanted to be by himself anymore.
Well, luckily he doesn't have to be. And he can just make more of him.
He's his own best friend. So,
right?
He's a mog. Half man, half dog.
He can make his own party. You never have to worry about it. God, can you imagine how annoying that has to be your own best friend, to have multiples of you? You know, I already know I'm annoying. And let alone, like, if I have to talk to, like, three of myself. God, I don't even want to think about that Game of Thrones party. That would be awful.
Oh, my God, exactly. You know, I'm already a self-loather to begin with.
So this differs from your normal book. Was this bookended by anything? I mean, was this coming out of...
No, it was just a standalone issue. It was just one standalone issue.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What did you take away from it? Like, so you really liked the issue because of the fact that you got to learn a lot of the backstory that you didn't get to learn, which Peter David does an amazing job with that. He's almost like the Marvel's, you know, like Batman Grant Morrison, where he gets into the head and the pretext of every character that he writes and really wants to get into the psyche of that character. What really made this book, aside from all that? So we know that it's about, you know, outside of every comic book, what was your takeaway from this? What made you really think this was the book that stood out from every other book? Whenever somebody says comic book, this is the one that jumps into your head.
Again, it's I keep on stressing, and that is, again, it tells you why they do what they do, and it's not always because of heroics. It's not always because of fame. It's not because they are addicted to action,
right?
You know, or romance or whatever. The adrenaline's a flowing. It's, you know, there's always something behind everything. There's a reason behind everything. And that's the takeaway is, you know, Superman, for all he, you know, all the glory and everything he does, I mean, there's all meaning behind what he did. And that is, he's a farm boy that got raised by good values, and he wants to do good for the world.
Right.
You know, Batman, because his parents were murdered in front of him, he doesn't want to let anybody else have that pain that he suffered. He's going to fight everybody in the world. Not just Gotham, in the world. and that's the reasons behind the real reasons behind he's doing everything. So there's always that backstory, that psychological part of everybody that's just amazing. And just you just never thought of superheroes in that light before. Or at least I never did.
Right on.
Before that issue, I just thought, it's superheroes, you know, schnicky with Wolverine and whatnot. And then it opened my eyes to something I never thought of before.
There you go. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Thank you, Kelly and Josh. Identity Crisis is on my
short list. I'm sure they're thanking us for not, like, putting a bumper between every single.
Right. Trust me, we're going to get through this pretty quickly. You guys don't want to hear all the things that are hitting the edit room floor tonight. Identity Crisis, it was on my short list. And you heard that in the interview. It was very much on my list of best comics I've ever read. And we've talked about that too. And there's this idea that it's too dark, and it kind of goes back to what you were talking about with the Captain America book.
Absolutely.
Is that it's you're telling a story, and sometimes stories are dark. Sometimes you have to go to places that maybe makes the reader uncomfortable, but that's the point. It isn't death and darkness for the sake of death and darkness. So, and Josh, God love him. Who would have thought we asked somebody what their favorite comic book is and somebody would have come back with X Factor? But that's why I love him to death. The stuff about like Quicksilver, when you sit down and actually talk to him and he says that, you know, why he's such an asshole all the time is essentially because he has to wait on everybody and everything all the time is brilliant, you know? So yeah, thank you both, Kelly and Josh, for reminding us that the motivations that these heroes have and the stories that the writers have for them can be much deeper than, like we were talking about, wrecking New York. We're gonna rob a bank.
And what was nice with both of these is these were both stories I was not necessarily the actual X-Force issues per se, but I read some X-Force, quite a bit of it during Peter David's
reign.
During his reign. And really enjoyed where he took the mutant type character concept, and definitely was like everyone just completely blown away by Identity Crisis because of the depth.
Just insane.
And because it said, you know, just because you're a hero doesn't mean you always do the right thing, or sometimes you do the wrong thing for the right reason.
Right. And your reaction once you're a superhero, you have certain reactions to problems that most normal people don't have, you know. And that's the thing, is how do you deal with those things? All right. Moving on. Moving on. We had a lot of ground to cover still. Cole, why don't you take us into the next series of best comics I've ever read?
Well, let's go from, you know, just the deep and meaningful and sometimes shocking, turning comics on their ear type of fare that rated very heavily, very highly, rather, with a couple of our guests. And let's go into something a little more lighthearted and fun, because that's an aspect of comics that the initial reaction, you say comic books, people are thinking Superman, Batman, right. Spider-Man. They're not thinking humor. You know, some of the earliest comics, as we've talked about in our histories of comics, were more just humorous type of things, essentially where we got funny books from.
Right, right.
And occasionally you got that return to a humor book. So we have a couple of folks. We've got Rick Gutierrez, our fearless leader from over the United States of Geekdom.
Right.
Who struggled with, you know, narrowing down to just a couple. And then struggled and had those two slug it out. And as it worked out, had a really fun choice. A book not everybody necessarily knows. But it wasn't one of those that's just so obscure that it'll be featured on an issue about really obscure comics
right.
coming down the way.
Plug for our own show on our own show. Love it.
And then Catherine, Mrs. Jedi Cole, of course, from the new JCU series, What'd You Think?
And really one of the women behind this podcast.
Yes, exactly. And also the United States of Geekdom, of course. Both of them with taking a look at the lighter side of the best comic I ever read.
Hey, Andy. Hey, Cole. It's Rick from your other podcast, United States of Geekdom. That's at unitedstatesofgeekdom.com. Plug! Just wanted to weigh in with my pick for the best comic I ever read. Honestly, this was kind of a tough one for me to pick. I could have very easily gone with Excalibur, The Sword is Drawn, which is the very first Excalibur book that I picked up with my own money, and it has a lot of nostalgic value for me. I could have also gone with Dark Knight Returns. I could have gone with Batman Year One. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. No, honestly, there's one title that really comes to mind, and it's a book called Bone. It's by Jeff Smith, the publisher's Cartoon Books. Not even Marvel, not even DC, not even Image, y'all. Well, it was for a brief period of time, but then they reverted back to Cartoon Books, but that's neither here nor there. Bone is the story about three cousins, Phone Bone, Phony Bone, and Smiley Bone, and it's these three little bones, I guess they're called. They're from a town called Boneville, and they've been run out of town, or rather, Phony's been run out of town, and Phone Bone and Smiley Bone, being that they are Phony's loyal cousins, they travel along with him, and they end up getting separated and lost in, and wind up in this forest where they end up getting befriended by this girl named Thorn and this bug named Ted and a big red dragon. There's an old lady who likes to race cows, and it's just a tremendous amount of fun for a book. But then it goes deeper than that. There's a certain point in the story where it goes from somewhat happy, somewhat fun, somewhat goofy, to just completely dark. And we learn the secret of Thorn's grandmother, and we even learn the secret of Thorn. To avoid spoilers, I'm not going to say exactly what that secret is. But yeah, it's a fantastic story. It's got a lot of action. It's got a lot of humor. The characters are wonderful. The story is a lot of fun. It's one of those stories that I've been reading to my son, and he loves every single page of it. He thinks it's very funny. He loves the characters. The characters are so well written. Just everybody is extremely well written. There's a running joke with these two rat creatures that are talking about how hungry they are, and one of them is constantly suggesting how to make quiche, and the other one's just getting progressively more and more upset right up until the very end where they finally get their quiche. So I'm not going to say exactly how they get said quiche, but it definitely gets resolved, thankfully. But yeah, you know, there's my pick for the best book I've ever read, and it is available in a one-volume edition. It's easily over 1,000 pages. It's about $40, but well worth every single penny, and it's a tremendously engaging read. The art is beautiful. The story is fantastic. The characters are great. And so, yeah, there you go. Bone is my pick for the best comic I ever read. And, yeah, congratulations on 50 episodes, and keep them coming, guys.
Hi, this is Catherine Houston, also known as Mrs. Jedi Cole or Cat Fiction, and I'm here to talk about the best comic I ever read. It is going to be The Tick by Ben Edlund, and it was published in 1990 by New England Comics. The reason I absolutely loved The Tick, the original comic and the original issues, was that it was satire, absolutely wonderful satire on the superhero comic itself. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with The Tick as a character in its many incarnations that came along, but originally the comic itself was a satire. The reason I loved it so much is because it was the only comic that I could read where I would literally laugh out loud. I would have to stop reading because I was laughing so hard. It has characters in it that are nods to Superman and the Flash and all sorts of different supervillains, and one of them's a nod to Batman, and it's the Tick's interaction with these characters in their world, just kind of tossing their world upside down. And it's got some of the most wonderful hysterical situations that I had ever seen up to that point in a comic book. It's wonderful humor that knows its target market.
Also, this was a book that came out at a point where there were a lot of superhero parody books.
Right.
And I think you could certainly say that for its time, it was satire, like you said, brilliantly, satire rather than parody.
Right. Like, for example, they have a character in there called Oppenheimer, which is very obviously the Superman character trying to pass as Clark Kent. And the Tick gets a job at the newspaper working with him, and Oppenheimer doesn't like him a bit because he's nigh invulnerable, but he makes no attempt to hide his identity or shield the fact that he's a superhero. He's just out there, and while Oppenheimer's trying to conceal his identity and do everything in secret, and the Tick is really, really, really trying to get Oppenheimer to like him and doesn't understand why, you know, they can't be friends. And as a gesture of a goodwill, he takes Oppenheimer's car and twists it into an ashtray for him as a gift.
Yeah, and it certainly illustrates one of the qualities of the character is that he's got all the necessary traits of a superhero except for the mental capacity.
Right. He is that same. Even the later writers did manage to keep that wonderful oblivion about him. He's just totally everything is just new and different. It's just like he's walking into a whole new world every day, just trying to figure everything out. And it's juxtaposed by the fact that he is nigh invulnerable and just horrifically dangerous, but he's so mild and disconnected from everything that he's not necessarily, he fancies himself a hero, and yet, especially in the earlier comics, he can be in a situation where there's a victim and there's a bad guy, and he might disrupt the crime that's going on, but he doesn't necessarily save the victim. He's just there to stop the crime.
He has a level of cluelessness that,
yes,
kind of tempers his abilities as a superhero.
And one of his favorite things to do is hop from building to building. And, of course, as he's hopping from building to building, as he lands, these chunks of building are falling off, because when he lands, he just knocks stones and all sorts of debris from the top of the building to fall on the street below. There's a fantastic segment in here. Now remember, this is written like very at the tail end of the 80s, early 90s. Of one character, the speedster character, has gone to an agent to increase his PR by hiring a supervillain that he can fight in the middle of the downtown street, called the Red Menace. And of course, the Red Menace has the big Soviet emblem on him, and he's got the spikes, and he's all big and huge and menacing. They've worked out with the agent of, you know, how the speedster is going to defeat the Red Menace, and it's a set done deal. Well, everything's well and good, and except for here comes the Tick just happening along, and here's the Red Menace out in the middle of the street calling the speedster out. And of course, the Tick is just left stunned with tears of joy rolling down his face that he has a supervillain to fight, and just demolishes the Red Menace, and of course really ticks off the speedster because he's the one that paid for him in the first place.
Zach, where would you find Tick other than maybe the occasional back issue bin?
They did collect a majority of the issues in, I think there were there's three collections. There's one called the Tick Omnibus, O-M-N-I-B-U-S, and it's called Sunday Through Wednesday, that collects, I believe, about 10 issues. There's another one, a Tick Omnibus 2, Thursday Ad Infinitum, that collects, I think, 4 issues. And there's also a Tick Omnibus 3 that's rather thin, that has a couple more issues in it, and also an art gallery and some other materials in it. Unfortunately, for reasons which I probably used to know but I don't know now, Tick came strong out of the gate and was published regularly, and then the issues became further and further between, and it finally just ended. Ultimately, other writers took up the line along with the other characters and took it in different directions. Paul the Samurai, one of the characters, took off and did a couple of issues. There were also some standalone issues with a couple of some of the other characters, some done by Ben Edlin, but later on a new writer took over. The Tick himself stopped being satire and started being a character unto himself with his own villains, and it kind of, the flavor changed. The character himself is still charming, but it lost that side-splitting humor that it had in the beginning, which is unfortunate, but things like that change over time. And, of course, the listeners probably are more familiar with it with the animated series, which I do believe Ben Edlin was involved with at the beginning, but left ultimately.
Thank you, Ray Romano and Catherine, for your... Oh, was that actually Ray Romano? Did we get a celebrity on here to talk about his favorite comic?
I'm sorry, I fooled you good there. That was just Rick.
Oh, well. Well, I mean, it is Rick.
But the interesting thing is Rick was actually reading Ray Romano's response to the best comic I've
ever. It's nice that we have that at our disposal. So yeah, I mean... What can you say about those two books? What can you say about, you know, The Tick, and what can you say about Bone? They're amazingly
they're both one syllable.
They're both one syllable. Yes, thank you. This isn't Password. they're both amazingly unique books. They tell a unique story. And the cool thing about that is everybody has, like you said, in their mind, the idea of what sequential art is. It is a comic book. You have four panels, you have six panels, and you know, you got Superman throwing a punch, and then somebody taking a punch, and then the guy flying off into the, you know, into a mountainside. That's not what's happening here. And we've talked pretty lengthily, not so much about Bone, but definitely about Tick. And I think we absolutely love these books.
Yeah, the Tick's a fun one, because if you go back to the early days, if you're familiar, like Catherine mentioned, the animated series and the live-action series, series both, you could literally tell Ben Edlund's influence, you know, that he understood that character. I mean, he created the character, but he understood it better than anyone else.
Right.
Because most people misinterpreted the idea.
Yeah, like he was some kind of just big, dumb guy, like jockey and guy, and that's not the point.
They didn't know how to layer that character
right
the way Edlund did. But I don't think anyone could write it the way Edlund did.
Like you said about creator-owned materials, you know, it's
oh, yeah, if it's very often, only the people who created understand the character at all.
Right, or understand it better than anyone else, can make it sing and dance better than anyone else can. So thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Rick, for your contributions to this annual. You guys have been integral to the show itself, so I really appreciate you guys coming out. Speaking of integral to the show, two guys who absolutely have not at all been any part of this show whatsoever over the past year, Bobby, the machine, or as I'm going to call him, Bobby, Needful Things, Blakey. I don't know why. Maybe Tommy.
Why
Knockers.
Not? I mean, that's when it comes to Bobby, it's just a question of why not.
Yeah. Bobby is a machine. Bobby is really the guy that I'm gonna call him the mangler. He just gets in there and does it. He's amazing. Eddie, Funky Cold Medina, has guest hosted, been a regular guest, was a guest on my favorite episode we've ever recorded, which was Super Pro Bowl Sports Balls. the best show.
Pro Bowl Sports Balls was amazing.
I don't even know how to quantify what happened on that show, but I'm right now, can you hear me smiling right now just thinking about recording that show? It was beautiful. It was the stars aligned, and you know, the portals opened up in the sky, and we had our first Vulcan contact right there. That's what happened. Really, we get to talk to a couple artists here, a couple artists, a couple creators that have used this opportunity to tell us about the best comic they ever read, to tell us how it informed their art and their style and who they are. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the old virtual mic over to Bobby and Eddie, and let them tell you their story there.
Well, mine it's not so much, I guess, unless you kind of collected edition, mainly because the one thing that really stood out, I can't remember the actual issue number, but it was I believe a 6-issue miniseries is for Johnny the Homicidal Maniac.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it had a big following, obviously, because it went into numerous printings, but unless you're a hardcore comic geek, most people ask, they have no idea what I'm talking about.
So what was it?
It was a very independent book. I believe Slave Labor Press or Graphics, whatever it was, put it out. Okay. It was kind of a hodgepodge of a lot of things. You know, you had a main story of the Johnny the Homicidal Maniac character. Then there was a lot of little sub-stories. There was a character named Wobbly-Headed Bob. There was like a stick figure character that Johnny actually drew that was his own comic within the comic that just stood on a box and screamed at people's obscenities and yelled at them. Then there was a Squee character. So it was kind of it was this very, very independent, you know, you look at it, it just looked like a chaotic train wreck.
Yeah.
But it was so detail-oriented, it was just brilliant.
What was it about? Like, I know it's hard.
I couldn't even really explain it. The easiest I can say is it's about a serial killer who was trying to find his way into like a normal life.
Okay.
But he couldn't let go of his insanity. So he had all the crazy aspects of killing people, but it wasn't about just watching him kill. It was watching him befriend this little boy, Squee, who was terrified of him. But this guy, for some reason, loved this kid. And then the just demented world that he lived in, and some of the stories were like going to his mind, and then for some random reason there was these other stories that had nothing to do with the rest of the story. You know, which there's one of those stories which is what sucked me to the book, so kind of made it so memorable to me. And I believe I talked about it on one of the other shows that we did, or that I guest hosted with you. I didn't do it. It was your show.
Oh, we did it.
but it was basically a simple, just a couple of page story of a guy on a date, and he suddenly realized his stomach was churning and he needed to go take a dump. And as he's sitting there and his stomach's churning, he's trying to figure out, you know, you're on a date. You don't want to say, excuse me, I have to go to the restroom because it's kind of embarrassing. You know, it shouldn't be because everyone's doing it. But for some reason, right. It's uncomfortable.
Well, so you want to make that impression, that first impression.
Right.
You know.
And he stands up to make the move. But when the person, the female character says, where are you going? He panics. And he's like, oh, no, I'm not fine. He sits back down. Well, now it's turning worse, getting the squishy sounds, and now he can't get up again because now he's going to look like a tool.
Right.
So you know, now he's going to look crazy, as if he's not crazy enough dealing with this situation. So he finally has this epiphany, and as he has it, you hear this squishy, watery, like, dialogue written all over the page where you know he's now crapping himself. So he just jumps up. I'll never forget this. It's like this gigantic bubble, word bubble of him jumping up and says, oh my God, someone put shit in my pants. And he just runs, you know, excuse my French, but it's a medical term. But he goes, he just runs, and there's like, it's drawn with like poo flying out the bottom of his pants leg. And the person at the table is just sitting there in shock. But the little attention to detail there, like, sells the whole thing. It was just one of those things, like, in a comic I've never seen.
Guys like you and I, we've been into comics for a really long time. We've read a ton of really good books. What set this one apart for you? What made this one special to you as opposed to all the rest of them?
It actually has a couple of things for me. Is one, it was probably the very first – well, I don't want to say the first, but one of the – in a couple of book moment there of the first time of really getting into independent books.
Okay.
Now, I was into Image, like a lot of the people at that time, but even then, those were still kind of independent mainstream, if you will. This was more of an underground book, along with Poe, that I used to read.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe they were from Slave Labor as well.
I think so.
But what was interesting about this book is the covers and the interior of this book didn't match. You know, you looked at the covers, and it was these beautifully painted, psychotic works of a maniac. You opened it up, the beauty painting is gone, and it's just the works of a maniac. But they're so brilliantly written, but at the same time, when you look at it, it was so simplistic in nature, and there was no rhyme or reason. Gone were the standard panels, the way a comic's supposed to be written.
Yeah.
There wasn't a word bubble fit in, so you didn't cover art. I mean, you may get one where you just see a dude's eyes, his nose, and his mouth, and his face, and the rest of the panel is just words.
Right.
And as an artist looking at that and wanting to do comics, it made me realize, oh my God, you can do anything you want. I don't have to follow rules. And then at the same time, I think it's the stuff like the story I told you that was so out there and so away from the normal.
Yeah.
It opened my eyes to a different world of comics that I realized, you know, there's stuff out there that's way better than necessarily the mainstream, or at least gives you a different feeling as opposed to, you know, it's like seeing that movie that nobody else has ever seen, and you're like, why would people not watch this?
Yeah.
Because it never played at theater, and it never was on video. You happen to catch it on cable on the Independent Film Channel at like 2 in the morning. And nobody in the world knows what you're talking about, but it's the greatest movie ever. But then suddenly one other person sees it, and it blows up everywhere.
Right, right. Somebody goes out and starts proselytizing for this, whatever it is, this piece of media, you know, comic book, movie, album that came out, and all the, you know, like, 6 months from then, it's huge and everywhere, and you're like, no, that was, I was doing that, that was mine.
Right, and see, and this is a perfect case of, I want to be the guy that says, no, that was mine, but by the time I got into that book, they were already starting to, I mean, I lucky got a first printing, but by the time issue 3 came out, I want to say they were already on fourth or fifth printing of that book. So there was already a fan base for that. And for those that don't know about the book still, which I guarantee there's probably still a lot of people that have no idea about that book, it's the artist and creator-writer, total maniac that did it is Johan Vasquez.
Yeah.
Who also did Invader Zim for Nickelodeon and that ninth grade ninja one for, I think, Disney or XD.
Okay.
I don't know if he did the full Disney one, but I know his art. He's doing some, at least art designs for it.
It looks real similar. Yeah.
Yeah, but Invader Zim was his full baby, and you can, if you've ever read that book or the Squee book, and you watch Invader Zim, you can't help but see it. I mean, the designs didn't change much from the two characters.
I was always wondering, you know, watching Invader Zim, how did they reel him in? you know, because... No,
but if you really watch that show, they didn't rein him in all that much.
No, they really didn't.
Because that show, I mean, you know, the before I got... And it's funny, before I even knew... Invader Zim actually fell in the same category for me, ironically enough, in animation, because I didn't know he did a cartoon.
Yeah.
And I wasn't following Nickelodeon. That was Pinwheel and all that crap that, you know, I'd left Nickelodeon. I grew up, you know.
Right, right.
And I got introduced to it, actually, by the time they were... It was, I think, already off the air, and they were releasing it to video. And I picked one up. I saw it at the video store or something, and I said, "That looks familiar," you know. But you know, I'm thinking it's a copycat. And I started looking at it, and I see his name on the credit. So I bought all of them. And by the episode when the school's infested with lice,
yeah,
I'm like, "Oh my god, this is so him." I mean, right. I could see this story if you got rid of all these characters, threw in Squee, Johnny, and Wobbly Headed Bob, and it'd be the same book.
Right, right. You know? It would be the same thing. It'd just be,
yeah, that would have been such a so much better series if they had just let him full on, you know. But obviously, it wouldn't have been on Nickelodeon.
Right, right. Been on Showtime or HBO with the Max or whatever
that
was.
I think the other thing that I love about that book and its creator is he's so elusive that, like, I don't even know what the guy looks like.
Yeah.
You know, I've never met him at a convention. I've never seen him show up at a convention. I've never seen him advertise for a convention. You know, I don't know what he looks like. I've searched stuff, and I'm sure I could find it, but I try not to at this point because I like the mystery of that guy.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it as usual, sir.
Eddie, what is the best comic that you've ever read?
Man, that is a tough question.
It's broad, right? It's broad.
There's like so many, and it took me a while to kind of narrow it down. But I had to narrow it down based on my favorite series of all time, which would be G.I. Joe.
Oh, okay. And okay.
Yeah, that being because, I mean, anybody who knows me now probably would think as a kid, my big thing was Star Wars and Raiders. And even though those were my favorite movies, it was really G.I. Joe that was kind of like the centerpiece of my childhood. I mean, that kind of defined so much of it because that defined the what I watched on TV, the toys I bought, the comics I read.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and even role-playing, you know, as a kid, you know, on the playground, my big thing was to pretend I was one of the G.I. Joes and get my buddies to all join in, too. So...
Yes. I've been, hey, you know what? That's kind of standard, right? I mean, I think we all did that.
What, yeah. which was kind of cool because when Colleen started cosplaying a couple years ago and her first cosplay was the Baroness, I was like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. So now we go run around in the backyard, you know, shoot at each other. I was like, you know, Snake Eyes, and she was Baroness, and the neighbors, we have all these neighbors, they're all elderly.
Yeah.
So they're like coming out the back porches looking like, what in the world is going on over there? It was young whippersnappers over there.
You're like, and your first thought is, I've chosen wisely. I've chosen my mate wisely. Or she chose wisely, maybe. Yeah. Or I'm a really, really lucky one of those. So do you have a favorite issue within the because there's been so many iterations of G.I. Joe. Do you have like a favorite issue within the confines of G.I. Joe?
Yeah, I'm going to take it back to the Larry Hama era because that, like, again, that's what defines G.I. Joe as we know it.
Right.
But to be more specific, I mean, gosh, when I think of this series, I think of two or three key issues, but I would have to go with G.I. Joe number one, only because it was so on target with just hooking me. And I remember at the time, you know, of course, as a kid, you go to 7-Eleven, you buy the stray issue of comic books, but it was my brother Vic who really kind of, I can credit to getting me interested in actually collecting comics as opposed to buying them and then stuffing them away in the toy box.
Okay.
But I remember we went to Target. You know how they would sell the comics usually bagged by threes and you can get them in a poly bag with three different issues?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I remember this time, this particular one, they had it poly bagged by itself, G.I. Joe number one. And my guess is because it was like a double size thick issue.
Yeah.
But I remember going and buying it. And I remember going home, getting on the bed and reading that thing. And I was just like blown away. I mean, I had read comics here and there, but nothing like that first issue of G.I. Joe just like hooked me. I was like so enthralled by these characters and the way it was written and the way the story played out. And on top of that, what was so cool to me was, not only did it have the main, you know, story, but it had a backup story and it had some pinups. It had this one diagram where it was like a 2-page spread where it was a cutout side diagram of the pit there underground.
I remember those things were so cool because they had them in every single issue almost. Where you would have you know, the pit, and I remember the one for the pit, but there were also like you got the specs on the Apache helicopter and like the tanks and all that.
Oh yeah, exactly. And I don't know, man. It was just like something just went off, and I just connected with these characters, and that just evolved into, you know, seeking out more issues and seeking out the toys, and you know, and then. It seems like the cartoon came out after the comic, I'm pretty sure. And I remember when that first 5-part miniseries came on TV, I just went crazy. That was, like, that was it for me. But, I'd have to credit that very first issue because...
Okay.
You know, and it did more than just influence my childhood. it really kind of went beyond that, in that as an artist, you know, since I was able to pick up a pencil, I was drawing, drawing things. But up until that point, I was drawing everything just like cartoon characters, you know, like out of the newspaper, I'd copy the comic strips and try to mimic their styles.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until G.I. Joe, particularly that issue, you know, how it just, you know, just was just so mind-blowing that I started at that point trying to draw a little bit more realistic like the comic book artists of that time did.
Right.
And so... It kind of really goes just beyond, you know, just collecting as a kid at that point. It really, even to this day, has influenced me and my decisions on my career and everything.
Your artistic decisions. Last question for you on this is there a particular G.I. Joe comic book character that you identify more with than any other one?
Yeah. Okay. This is probably not a conventional one, but, you know, most people want to say Snake Eyes or
sure.
Or and early on, it was kind of from that first that first issue. It was kind of Breaker. I don't know why.
Okay.
A little bit less, you know, like your standard tough guy Joe. He was more of like, you know, the brainiac. And believe me, I was not a brainiac in school. I don't know. There was something about him, but I think really overall, if I could identify with one G.I. Joe, it would be Mutt. And I don't know if it's because he is a dog lover, and I'm a huge dog lover. I mean, Colleen and I don't have kids for the one reason is that we're such big dog lovers. Our dogs are our kids, basically.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It could be the fact that he was, you know, a dog person, or it could have just been that really cool Tom Selleck type mustache.
Nice.
I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been.
But,
ladies and gentlemen, Eddie, quote-unquote, Funky Cold of Medina, bringing you G.I. Joes. Thank you so much, Eddie.
Thanks.
Well, that was no less in both cases than I would have expected from either of them. Not to say that I would have ever anticipated their choices.
Yeah, that's And in Bobby's defense, Bobby recorded that interview twice. I will tell you that up front because it's Bobby, and he will tell you the same. The interview that we have is better than the interview that we recorded the first time. But Bobby had a sense of energy in the first interview that I don't think that I've ever seen him have when talking about a comic or anything for that matter. Bobby's usually pretty laid back. He'll tell you a story and it's no big deal. Bobby really loves Johnny the Homicidal Maniac.
Yes, indeed.
Like really loves it. So that in a. I never knew. I guess I knew, but I never knew that Eddie was such a big G.I. Joe fan.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because, I mean, I'd seen Colleen's costume before, the Baroness costume.
Right.
But I never knew what it meant.
Well, and you see him on Facebook. I see him post stuff about G.I. Joe, you know, like occasionally. But yeah, so we all post stuff about G.I. Joe occasionally. And he gets on there and he's like, you might not know this, but I'm the biggest G.I. Joe fan ever. I'm like, I did not know this. All right. Now we're in business. Now we can talk about something. So, guys, Bobby, Eddie, when you listen to this, I just want to personally tell you thank you for all your contributions to what we've done over the past year. In art, in being here for us and helping us, you know, write funny things sometimes and being part of that writer's room that we've kind of built, and just being awesome, awesome guys and open for anything and everything, just down for whatever at any time. You guys are awesome. And thank you for being a part of this show. Those are the contributions from our friends of the show. Thank you, Jason, Kelly, Josh, Rick, Catherine, Bobby, and Eddie, and Cole, because Cole
and
gave us.
Thank
his
you
too.
For remembering, for like having all those names and being able to rattle them all off. Quick succession.
Keep in mind
that was a beautiful thing.
Keep in mind, I've been editing these things, so I've been. I've been staring at them for a while. Not that I wouldn't, because they're all amazing people. And you, Cole, for giving us yours, which I fully was expecting of one of the issues of Watchmen. And thank you for surprising me.
Yeah, I kind of held that back before we were recording just so you'd keep that.
Yeah, you did. You would tell me, you jerk. So that's it, guys. That's the annual. That is our one-year mark. I figured it was a good way to wrap up a year talking about the best comics we ever read and why. I really hope you guys enjoyed it. I really hope you guys enjoyed this last year. I can tell you that we did. We enjoyed the hell out of it. Cole, what do you got for us?
Well, we are about to launch into a new story arc as we pick up at number 51.
Are we going to launch into it, or is it more of a spasm?
Well, it could go either way because we really haven't decided. We've got some really good story arcs coming up for you.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of debate as to which one we're the most anxious to jump into.
I think there is. I'll tell you, I would really want to do the broken continuity story arc. I want to talk about reboots and wiping the slate clean. I've been going back and doing some.
Well, we have sort of promised that, so I think yes, we will definitely then be jumping into the middle and sides, top, bottom.
We're gonna spasm
middle.
Into this thing. We're not gonna walk in.
We will spasm into continuity is not absolute.
There you go. I'll tell you the reason that I really want to do this right now is I went back and reread all the. I found a bunch of old comics. And I went back and reread the Marvel relaunch, Marvel Reborns, number ones, after Onslaught. Do you remember that? Where it was the Rob Liefeld Captain America, the Jim Lee Fantastic Four and Iron Man, and then the Avengers. I don't know if you remember that relaunch that happened.
Okay, yes.
After Xavier and
Magneto.
You know,
that sounds like fodder for the next...
Yeah,
story arc.
And that's exactly what it was. I was reading it and I was chomping at the bit to get all up into that story arc. So I cannot wait. Guys, I can't express to you how amazing this last year has been when it comes to this show. And I'm not going to get all maudlin and emotional about it. But I will tell you this, that I've podcasted for quite a long time, and I know Cole has too, but there's just something about this experience that is magical. And thank you, Cole, for being there for a year for me and for the listeners and you know, putting your time and sometimes your sanity and Catherine's time and sanity and everything else on hold so that you can do this for however long it takes weekly and giving us something.
You know, that was really why I felt like we had to do the annual, not only just to honor the whole issue-by-issue comic book motif.
Right.
But also to, you know, sell.